Okay, welcome back everyone to the Strong Gravity Seminar. We're fortunate today to have Julia Cusin with us from the University of Geneva. She obtained her PhD in 2017 from the University of Geneva, then went on as a postdoc to the University of Oxford. And since this year is back in Geneva. And today will tell us about astrophysical backgrounds of gravitational waves. So we are looking forward to your talk. I should probably, before we start, mention that everyone is invited to stay on the call after the talk, just for a little more of an informal chat with Julia. Usually, we would grab some coffee at PI and have some chat over coffee. And now we'll try to replace this with just staying a little bit longer here on the Zoom call and chat a little bit. So everyone is invited to stay on the call for a little longer. Okay, please take it away, Julia. We're looking forward to your talk.
Okay, thanks a lot for this introduction and for the invitation. It's very nice to be to give this talk to your group. Okay, so today I will talk about my recent research aimed to the characterization of the properties of a stochastic background of gravitational waves of astrophysical origin. This talk is mainly based on this list of works done mainly in collaboration with a group in IAP in Paris, namely Jean-Philippe Uzon, Cyril Pitrou, and Irina Dvorkin, and some more recent work with David Alonso and Pedro Ferreira in Oxford and Carlo Contaldi and Arianna Renzini in Imperial College London. So I will try to make this talk quite pedagogical and don't hesitate to interrupt me if you have questions, comments, or you want some more clarifications. Okay. So this is the outline of this presentation. I will start defining what is an astrophysical background of gravitational waves and summarizing the state of the art of observations and of theoretical modeling. And then I will present a theoretical framework to fully characterize the properties of this background in terms of its map and spectrum of anisotropies and polarization. And I will present numerical predictions for angular power spectra of intensity, anisotropy, and polarization in different frequency bands accessible by different experiments. And then I will explain why this is a new observable that is potentially quite interesting for astrophysics and which type of astrophysical information can be extracted out of a future comparison between theoretical predictions and observations data. We know that we are living an interesting period for gravitational wave astronomy. We had a few years ago the first detection of a gravitational wave event coming from the merger of two compact objects. This discovery by the LIGO Virgo collaboration was then followed by many other detections of similar events. However, this was just the beginning of a new epoch, because in the next few years, we will have a new generation of gravitational wave detectors, such as Einstein Telescope and Cosmic Explorer, working in more or less in the same frequency band as LIGO Virgo, but with a much improved sensitivity. Then we have LISA flying in hopefully 10 years and working in the mid-band. And then at even lower frequencies, we can use pulsar timing arrays and set constraints on tensor modes, primordial tensor modes, using CMB polarization. So in total, we will cover almost 20 orders of magnitude in frequency, and we are looking at a completely different frequency bands with respect to the one we have assessed to with the electromagnetic radiation. In this slide, the electromagnetic spectrum would be outside here at much, much higher frequency. So we expect to detect new astrophysical sources with a high detection rate, and also the discovery of a background of gravitational waves will probably become a reality, as I will explain. But what is an astrophysical background of gravitational waves? So we can distinguish two types of astrophysical gravitational wave observables. We have signals from astrophysical sources that we can detect individually and localize in space. And then we have this background that is the superposition of all signals emitted by all sources around us in the universe up to a very high redshift. In the first case, for resolvable sources, the quantity that we measure is a waveform as a function of time and frequency. Then if we have a theoretical model for this waveform comparing what comes out from our interferometers to our theoretical model, we can first of all identify the nature of the source that is emitting. We can understand if we are looking at the merger of two compact objects or at a supernova that is exploding. And then once we have identified the nature of the source, we can extract its astrophysical properties. If we are looking at a binary system of compact objects, we can extract the masses of the two objects, the luminosity distance, the spins. For a background, the quantity that we actually observe is a map of intensity and a map of polarization at different frequencies. And the astrophysical information encoded is the collective astrophysical properties of a given population of sources, such as how sources are distributed in redshift, which is the distribution of masses, and how sources evolve with time. In this talk, so this is the observable I am interested in. And in this talk, I will often make use of an analogy between gravitational backgrounds, so backgrounds of gravitational waves, and backgrounds of electromagnetic radiation, because photons and gravitons behave in a similar way under a lot of aspects. So for both electromagnetic radiation and gravitational waves, we can have a background of cosmological origin and a background of astrophysical origin. For the electromagnetic radiation case, the background of cosmological origin is the CMB, the cosmic microwave background, so the radiation emitted at the instant of time at which photons stopped interacting with other particles and then that we collect at our telescope. And the background of astrophysical origin is the so-called infrared extragalactic background. This is the superposition of all the electromagnetic radiation emitted by all galaxies around us in the universe. So in the same way as this astrophysical background here, the CIB, cosmic infrared background, is a foreground for the CMB, so we need to characterize it and subtract it from an observed map to look at what is left. So cosmological background. A background of astrophysical origin for gravitational waves is a foreground for cosmological backgrounds of gravitational waves, such as tensor MOST produced in the early universe during inflation or reheating. So we need to have a proper characterization and an understanding of this background if we want to be able to subtract it from an observed map and look at what is left. The quantity that is traditionally used to describe a background of gravitational waves is this quantity here, omega gravitational wave as a function of frequency. This is a dimensionless quantity and defined as the logarithmic derivative of the energy density of the background normalized over the critical density of the universe. And if we want to have a first taste of the astrophysical information contained in this quantity, we can use this parametrization. So we integrate over redshift. At a given redshift, we count how many astrophysical sources we have. We multiply the number density of sources by the rate of gravitational wave events, such as the merger rate, and then by the spectrum that is emitted every time I have a given event. Here I show you predictions for this guy here as a function of frequency for a background that is given by the merger of compact objects, binary systems of compact objects, so neutron stars and black holes. This background component is expected to be the dominant component in the LIGO-Virgo background, a frequency band. So here in purple is the prediction for a background coming from mergers of binary black holes, and in green for a background coming from mergers of binary neutron star systems. And here you see the sensitivity curve. In gray is the sensitivity curve that LIGO will reach at the end of its life, the design sensitivity. For the moment, we don't have a detection, but we have only upper bounds on this omega. But a detection will be is possible seemingly quite soon. Now let me zoom in this region. This is just a zoom around this hot sweet spot here. So you see that there is a superposition between these curves and this sensitivity curve. So this indicates that if we trust these predictions, a detection of this omega will be possible before LIGO will reach the design sensitivity. Then Einstein telescope will work in the same frequency band, but with a sensitivity improved in strain of a factor 10 with respect to LIGO, so a factor 100 in omega, that is quadratic in the strain. So Einstein telescope, this is the sensitivity curve in the D configuration that will be probably the one adopted. Einstein telescope will detect a broader region of these curves. Let's now go to the LISA band. So LISA will see a background coming from the superpositions of the inspiring phase of a bunch of binary systems orbiting around in the universe. And the background that LISA will see is a background, intrinsic background, in the sense that it's stationary and continuous over the time of observation. On the other side, LIGO will see the very final phase of the evolution of these binary systems, and the duration of the merger phase is very short. So LIGO will see a series of transitive events with almost no time overlap. If you want to have a sound representation of what LIGO will see, this will be a background like this. That is, and this is called popcorn-like background, while LISA will see a background that is continuous and stationary. And this is an important distinction. We will go back to this point later in this talk. Okay, so for the moment, I was using a quantity that was just a function of frequency, the omega gravitational waves. But a more accurate way to go is to use a quantity that is also a function of the direction in the sky I'm pointing to my detector, and such that when I integrate it over the solid angle, this goes back, gives me back my original omega. And LIGO Virgo do have directional searches implemented, and for the moment they see something compatible with Gaussian noise, so no detection for the moment. But the methods to extract a map are already in place. Good, so this is what I wanted to say on the experimental side. Let's now pass to the theoretical modeling part. Until a few years ago, the way this background was described was assuming that the distribution of sources in the universe is isotropic around us, around the observer. So in this schematic situation, this observer receives exactly the same flux of gravitational waves in any direction. But actually, a more realistic situation is something like this, where astrophysical sources are located into galaxies and galaxies are embedded in the cosmic web. In this situation, this observer does not receive the same flux in any direction, and there is a primary source of anisotropy due to the fact that sources are not isotropically distributed, and the secondary one due to the fact that once a signal is emitted, it feels the gravitational potential of structures, so it is deflected, it is lensed. And so having in mind a picture like this, with my collaborators, we have proposed a way to describe the generation of polarization and the anisotropies observed for an astrophysical background. But now let me take a step back and recall what it is done to describe temperature anisotropies for the CMB. Because the framework that we use is inspired by what the people in the past did in this context. So the CMB is, as we said before, the radiation emitted at the instant of time at which photons stopped interacting with other particles. So it is emitted from the so-called last scattering surface. This is an almost constant redshift type of surface. Radiation is emitted here with a black body spectrum. And then it propagates in a universe where there are cosmic structures, and then it reaches the observer. Now, in this case, we have a black body spectrum, so we can characterize the intensity of this radiation in terms of one parameter, that is the temperature. And if I want to relate the temperature that I observe to the temperature at the last scattering surface, what we usually do is to compute this ratio, where k is the wave vector of the photon, and u is the commoving velocity of an observer. This is evaluated at the observer position, and this is evaluated on the last scattering surface. Now, let's do the mental experiment, and let's assume that structures are not there. So my metric is a Friedman-Robertson-Walker metric. This is homogeneous and isotropic. And in this picture, this observer would see exactly the same temperature in any direction. If this was the case, we would just measure a flat temperature map. Now we plug structures back. So my metric now contains gravitational potentials that describe the gravitational potential of the last scale structure. We repeat the same exercise as before, and we write which is the temperature observed now as a function of the direction. And we find this expression for temperature fluctuations, the well-known Maxwell formula, where there is a term evaluated at the last scattering surface and a term integrated along the line of sight. Now, this quantity is stochastic because it depends on stochastic variables, peculiar velocities, potentials, and over densities. So it can be characterized in terms of its angular power spectrum. So we can have a prediction for the angular power spectrum. Then CMB anisotropies are measured. We can extract an angular power spectrum from a measured map. And from a comparison between the observed angular power spectrum and the predicted one, we have been able to set constraints on cosmological models and cosmological parameters. Now let's go back to our picture here, to the astrophysical background of gravitational waves. So now sources are a bit everywhere, so they are not emitted from a constant redshift hypersurface, and we collect the signals here. The quantity that plays the role of the temperature now is this omega gravitational waves as a function of frequency and direction. And this quantity is stochastic, so we can compute its angular power spectrum. Then in the future, we will have a measurement of a map of the anisotropy of this guy. So we will be able to extract an angular power spectrum from data. And comparing observations to predictions, potentially we will be able to set constraints on several astrophysical quantities, such as stellar evolution model for star collapse, fraction of black holes in binary systems, and the distribution of masses of compact objects. Okay, so let's go now to some technical details. So this is a picture of the framework that we want to describe. Here we are pointing our instrument in a given direction, and what we see here are galaxies. And the total flux of gravitational waves that we receive is just the sum of the fluxes from all these galaxies. The idea now is to write the flux that I receive from a given galaxy in terms of quantities that are describing the process of gravitational wave emission inside the galaxy. And to do so, we need to distinguish different scales in the problem and coarse grain from one scale to the other. The first scale is the largest one and is a cosmological scale. So we see galaxies that are moving with the cosmic flow. Then we jump inside the galaxy, and we have a look at what's going on inside this galaxy, and we associate to the galaxy an effective luminosity of gravitational waves that takes into account the contribution from all the sources inside it. And that is a function of macroscopic quantities describing the galaxy, such as the galaxy mass and the mass density. So we write a flux that we receive from a galaxy at a redshift Z, in terms of this usual prefactor, where this is the luminosity distance of the galaxy, times this effective luminosity of gravitational waves.
Julia, just a quick question. How would you entangle, or how would you
know? Just speak a bit louder.
Yeah. How do you know which galaxy is the gravitational wave source at, given that you can redshift away and then change it to another one? So how would you disentangle that, I guess?
I'm not sure that I understand the question. Your question is, how can you disentangle between a galaxy that is closer and emits has less luminosity from a galaxy that is far away but that is brighter, something like this?
So I mean, I can, there is a redshift uncertainty in the masses of the system. So okay. I can have many galaxies in the light of sight. How would I be able to assign the binary source to this galaxy and not the galaxy that is further out along the same line of sight?
But actually you don't care, because what you want to do is describe all what is out there. So you need a model for your distribution of galaxies, and then you need to populate galaxies. And the way you populate galaxy depends on the astrophysical model that you assume. And then, of course, once you have the distribution of galaxies, so you know the redshift of each galaxy, and you know what's going on inside each galaxy, you just sum all these contributions. And the information about redshift is lost, because you always integrate along your line of sight. So you never ask yourself the question, which is the contribution from a galaxy? Am I seeing a contribution from a galaxy that redshift one or a redshift two? Because you have always an integrated effect.
But, sorry, maybe I got confused. When in the previous slide, you were saying that you could tell something about the distribution of binaries in the universe.
Yes, exactly. So, yes, I've thrown that there, but I will get back in detail. You're referring to this kind of.
Yep. Yeah.
Yes, so if you don't mind, I will get back to this, explaining in detail what I mean, which type of information exactly can be extracted.
Okay.
So let me go on, and I will try to answer your question. If I don't, interrupt me again. Can it work?
Sure. Thank you.
Thanks. Good. So. We were here, so we were looking at this picture, a lot of galaxies along the line of sight. And for the moment, we have understood how to write the flux from a galaxy at a given redshift in terms of luminosity of gravitational waves of this galaxy. And now we have to remember that we have a bunch of galaxies along this line of sight. So we multiply the flux from a galaxy at a redshift Z by the number of galaxies in a comoving volume around this redshift. And then we integrate over redshift. Now we rewrite this flux in terms of gravitational wave luminosity. This factor here in terms of a product of comoving density and comoving volume. And we obtain an expression that in a universe that is homogeneous with perturbations looks like that. So the only thing to notice here is the presence of two building blocks. Here there is a part that is a cosmological factor that depends on galaxy overdensity, peculiar velocities, and then there is an integrated effect. And then here there is this block that is an astrophysical kernel that depends on redshift and frequency, and that is can be written in this way. So at a given redshift, I count how many galaxies of a given type I have, and I multiply it by the effective luminosity of gravitational waves for galaxies of that type, and I integrate over a bunch of parameters that are describing my galaxy. This will be for us the galaxy mass.
So can I do something? So this E is like the angle on the sky, right?
Yes, exactly. The direction that I'm looking at.
Right. And so in practice for these, future experiments, so how well can this angle be measured?
Yes, that's a very good point. So you're asking which is the angular resolution of future detector networks.
Exactly.
Yes, I will address this point also in a while. I will show you predictions for the angular resolution of different networks. And sorry, let me become. So I will explain how to compute the angular resolution of a detector network. Just to give you a first idea, and then I will get back to this. The method that is used to construct a map is the same method that is used by people in radio astronomy. So you need a network of detectors, and then you cross-correlate the output of your detectors, and the angular resolution of your network corresponds to the roughly to the diffraction pattern of your network. And just to give you a spoiler, LIGO Virgo can go up to a multiple equal 4. So a very bad angular resolution. Things improve if you add also Kagra, but yes.
Could you also remind me again, back in the previous slide, how the cosmological, so that's the cosmological part in the integration. Mm-hmm. How did the metric come into that? So I see that the phi part goes into the A. That's the number of hosts that play the role, I guess.
Okay. Yes, good. So you rewrite this as the product of a, this is a number density, right? So you, it can be written as the product of commoving density times commoving volume. And then you need to decide which is your geometry, which is your metric. And for me, the metric is Friedmann with the scalar perturbations. So you need to write down the perturbation of your volume element in this metric. And then there are also cosmological factors entering here through this prefactor here. So you will have redshift perturbations and perturbation of the luminosity distance.
Okay, so that that particular parenthesis was just a volume factor because of the in the next slide, and not, right, this one. So it's
so
not
there are okay. Different terms come from at different origins. So this is a galaxy over density. So in this part, this will come from the commoving number density here. Mm-hmm. This is a term that depends on velocity that comes out from redshift perturbations.
Okay. Now I see it.
Okay, good. Don't hesitate to interrupt me. I prefer this way.
Mind if I keep on interrupting?
Sure.
Okay. So I'm trying to deal with the conceptual point, and I'm not sure I'm seeing this correctly. So so your starting point to construct the omega is the gravitational wave energy flux.
Yes.
Which is quadratic in the strain, and correct. What you measure is the strain, not the flux itself.
Yes.
So let's agree with that. So now you construct your delta omega from that, and then the proposal is that you're going to build correlation functions between delta omegas at different angles, and that's how you're going to build your sort of, you know, temperature map or...
That's right.
So now you're building up something that's fourth power in the strain.
That's correct.
And I'm wondering if that's really the best way to do this. I mean, couldn't you think of doing correlation functions with the strain itself?
No, that's the only way to go, actually, because the intensity is the only thing that correlates. The strain as a trivial correlation function is the delta function in direction space. And the reason why is that the strain in the context of a gravitational wave background is just a superposition of all what you receive from a given direction. So you are adding strains from contributions from different sources with the totally uncorrelated phases. So then when you cross-correlate the strain from a given direction with the strain from another other direction, you end up having summing phases that are uncorrelated, and the only non-vanishing contribution to the correlation function is the one diagonal.
Okay, yeah, thank you.
The same thing happens for the CMB. You correlate intensity, you don't correlate the electric field, because the electric field would have a trivial correlation function.
Thank you.
But that's an important point. Yes. Good.
Just follow up on that. Sorry. Okay. Right. Like. So here, I guess you're talking about the autocorrelation of the omega with itself. But if you cross-correlate omega, you know, with like the galaxies that are making, the emission, then it's just only two powers of the strain, right?
Yes.
And so in principle that might, you know, that might increase your signal to noise of the measurement, wouldn't it?
Yeah, that's correct. Okay. Indeed, I believe, and I will show this. So you are asking anticipations. I will show this. Probably the best way to have a first detection is using a cross correlation between this observable here and a galaxy map, because the signal to noise of this cross correlation is much better than the autocorrelation. That's true. Okay, very good. So I was saying that this kernel here is the messy part because it contains a bunch of ingredients that up to now are not really known. So let's have a look. So we said that into this guy, there is this effective luminosity. And this effective luminosity can be written as the product of a merger rate and the spectrum emitted every time I have a merger. The merger rate is the complicated part, depends on the star formation rate, on the stellar evolution model, your model for stellar collapse, the mass range that you assume for your compact objects, and so on. And all these ingredients up to now are not really constrained, they're huge uncertainties. So that I have decided to take with my colleague Irina Dvorkin was the approach. We said, okay, let's pick up a reference choice for all these ingredients and work out predictions for the angular power spectrum of omega for this astrophysical model. And as a second step, let's test of how much this angular power spectrum changes if I change one after one all these ingredients. For our reference astrophysical model, this is how this kernel looks like as a function of redshift for different frequencies. Then to work out an angular power spectrum, we need to evolve perturbations starting from initial conditions after inflation. And then we can go on. So we compute the correlation function of these guys, assuming statistical isotropy. This is boils down to the computation of an angular power spectrum for different frequencies. I have decomposed this in a basis of Legendre polynomials. Then omega, as it has already been pointed out, is a stochastic quantity. So it will also cross-correlate with any other stochastic cosmological observables. And in particular, it will cross-correlate with the galaxy number counts and with the weak lensing. So weak lensing describes the deformation of the shape of a galaxy due to the gravitational potential of structures along the line of sight. What we did is to consider three observables, these omega gravitational waves, weak lensing convergence that describes the isotropic deformation of a geodesic bundle, and then galaxy number counts. So we have a spectrum for the autocorrelation and a spectrum from cross-correlation with lensing and galaxy number counts. And each of these spectra are a function of frequency. Now let me show you some numerical predictions. This is what we get for the angular power spectrum. This is for the autocorrelation in the LIGO-Virgo band, and this is for a frequency in the LISA band. Here I have normalized the spectrum over the monopole, and I have multiplied it by a factor of L to stress the presence of a plateau at large angular separations. So there are two things to notice. The first one is, as I said, this plateau. And this was expected because the dominant contribution to the anisotropy is due to the galaxy distribution, and the typical behavior of the galaxy correlation function on large angular separations is 1 over L. And then we see that we have this plateau is at a level of 10 to the minus 4, so this means that anisotropies are typically suppressed by a factor 10 to the minus 2 with respect to the monopole. Remember that for the CMB, the suppression is of order 10 to the minus 5 to give a comparison. Okay, so let's remember these numbers, and we will get back to this when I will show you sensitivity curves per multiple for different detector networks. Here I show you the results for the cross correlations with the weak lensing convergence here, and here with the galaxy number counts at different redshifts. Let's focus on this, that is the most interesting observable. This is interesting for different reasons. The first one is that it allows one to have a tomographic reconstruction of the redshift content of this background, because the background itself doesn't contain any redshift information because I'm just integrating over the line of sight. But now if I cross-correlate with the galaxy distribution at different redshifts, I can pick up contribution from sources at different distances from me, from the observer. The second reason why this observable is relevant is for detection purposes. So let's imagine that I have I measure a map of this omega, and then I ask the question: is am I looking at an astrophysical background or at some exotic primordial universe component? Then a way to go is to cross-correlate this map with the galaxy map, because an astrophysical background is expected to be highly correlated with the galaxy distribution, while this is not the case for a cosmological background.
Can I ask, so in that previous slide that you were just showing, so this does not yet include, you know, the angular resolution of your gravitational wave detector, is that right?
Yes, these are pure theoretical predictions. There is no noise component inside here.
Yeah, okay. So why is it that the red curve, like, you know, just falls off a cliff like that?
Why is it that the red curve here falls off like this?
Yeah.
Let me think. So if you use, let's use the Limber approximation. So let's say that we have a relation between a multiple L and distance and the momentum K. So L is a distance times K. Then let's assume that we get typically, so there is a range of K that gives me a contribution, then small Ls pick up a dominant contribution from small distances. And as I increase L, I start seeing mainly big.
Big Ks. Yeah, that's right. You know, but there are certainly, angular fluctuations in galaxies at redshift less than 0.03 on scales of like degrees, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. All right. okay. Like, so for this, you use Limber, you're saying?
Yes, but yes. I'm using.
I see. Okay. Yeah. So Limber, of course, is only valid. What?
No. Wait. I don't use Limber to obtain the plot. I was trying to answer your question, assuming that Limber was a valid approximation, and saying let's assume that I have a contribution from a range of K, and so I have a relation between L and Z, and so small Z as I increase L, small Z will start not giving any contribution. But I'm not sure that is a particularly valid approximation.
Right. So ignoring, So ignoring K or Limber, observationally, galaxies at redshift of 0.02, 0.03, they have structure at L of 500 or 1,000, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay. All right. So, okay. Like, so therefore I shouldn't pay attention to that, you're saying.
You should pay attention to my explanation of using Limber, you mean?
No, I mean, like... Well, like
I need to, that's a good question. I understand perfectly your point. And you're a bit surprised by this behavior here. I never thought of this. I should think a bit more to answer your question. But I understand the point.
Okay, thanks.
Could you also remind me, I missed that part, like when you're doing the cross-correlation galaxies, are you doing simulation for galaxies or?
We are using, we are cross-correlating theoretical predictions for the galaxy number counts, so for the perturbation in the number of galaxies as a function of direction and redshift with our omega.
So, what do you use for your galaxy data? What kind of, like, you use CAMP or something or
yes,
model, and then
you can write down an analytic expression for the perturbation in the number of galaxies as a function of redshift and distance. The dominant term will be just a term like this. Galaxy over density, and then you have terms that depend on your peculiar velocities, on the gravitational potentials, integrated terms. So you can write down this expression for this guy explicitly. And then to work out numerical predictions, you need to use a code for the evolution of metric perturbations like CAMB.
Mm-hmm. So Okay, so you get delta M and then you make a model or assume a model for bias and then build on it. Okay.
And then you evolve gravitational potentials, peculiar velocities from an initial power spectrum. Okay, so I go back to this kind of master expression. I had told you that this guy depends on a bunch of ingredients that are not really constrained and that we had decided to fix the pickup choices for this to work out predictions for the angular power spectrum. And now let's test what changes if I change one after one these ingredients. So in all of this, I assume that this cosmological building block is fixed because we have several other cosmological probes that are setting constraints on cosmological parameters. So we just vary astrophysics.
One more question. So in the red box, is psi the metric potential here on the Earth? Is that what that means?
No. Psi here is the gravitational potential at a redshift z in a direction E.
I see.
There will be local terms at the observer, but this can be neglected.
Okay, got it. Okay, great. Thank you.
Okay. One more, can I also?
Sure.
This is a perfect model, right? You assume every, we have the actual, every galaxy that is produced is observable, or is that also encapsulated in the...
I wouldn't call it perfect in the sense that this is the thing that has to be done because you wanted to have a description of all what's going on there independently on the brightness of what is emitted because you are just at the detector and you keep on receiving signals here that contribute to that. So even very, very faint signals that couldn't be detected individually will add up and contribute eventually to this energy density amount. Mm-hmm. So you don't have to put any flux threshold to derive these predictions. Okay, so let me show you how much the angular power spectrum of this changes if I change astrophysics. And I will show you fractional differences with respect to my original astrophysical model. So this is the effect of changing the upper cutoff in the mass distribution of 10%. This gives a fractional difference of order 50%. Here we do the same, but we change the cutoff in mass, the lower cutoff, and we get a smaller difference. This is the effect of changing the stellar evolution model. Then other parameters and other astrophysical functions play a less important role. So of course, this is an explorative work. So the only take-home message is that we have an observable that is quite sensitive to how we describe astrophysics. And this is interesting because this means that if in the future we will able to construct from observations a spectrum of anisotropy out of a comparison between predictions and data, we will start setting constraints on some astrophysical functions such as stellar evolution model, the mass range of binary systems, and so on. Okay, for the moment, I've been talking about intensity, so this omega that is proportional to intensity and intensity power spectrum. But if you are familiar with the CMB, you know that CMB is described in terms of a spectrum of temperature, so intensity, but also in terms of polarization. So now the question is, what happens to polarization for a gravitational wave background? And if we want to make sure that we describe fully the properties of a background of radiation, a way to go is to introduce the so-called Stokes parameters. For a gravitational wave background, the way to go is to start from the strain. This is the strain as a function of direction and frequency with a composite in a basis of in a polarization basis. Out of these two amplitudes, we can build a tensor that is a complex 2 times 2 tensor called polarization tensor. that in full generality can be expanded in a basis of the identity matrix and the spin matrices. This coefficient here is intensity and is proportional to the omega that we have been dealing with. And then we have these parameters that are describing polarization. For the CMB, we know that there is a basic process responsible for the generation of polarization out of an unpolarized flux. This is a process of Thomson scattering, scattering of photons of electrons. And in particular, we need the two ingredients to generate a net polarization out of an unpolarized flux incoming here. We need a differential cross-section that depends on polarization of incoming and outgoing wave. And then we need a quadrupolar modulation in the flux of the incoming radiation here. Now, I was asking myself the question, is there, for gravitational wave backgrounds, a process analog to this process of Thomson scattering? And the process that I've considered is a process of classical diffusion of gravitational waves of massive objects. So this process here has to be treated as a process of wave scattering, and one can compute the differential cross-section that looks like this. So you see that there is a dependence on the polarization of incoming and outgoing graviton. Now, these objects are tensors and not vectors because we are dealing with a spin 2 object. And here we have spin 1. And then there is this prefactor here. When I derived this expression, I was very worried about this prefactor because I was expecting to find a structure exactly like the one of Thomson scattering. And then I realized that the presence of this prefactor is quite natural because this is the typical scaling of the Rutherford cross-section. This is a scattering of two charged particles. And this process is actually much more similar to a Rutherford scattering because gravitational waves are gravitationally charged while photons are not electromagnetically charged. So far so good. So we have the basic ingredients necessary to generate polarization. Now we can push the analogy with the CMB further and study what's going on if I have a flux of gravitational waves traveling in a region of space where I have a distribution of massive objects undergoing a process of multi-scattering or diffusion. This process can be described introducing an optical depth that depends on the number density of scattering centers and on the integrated cross-section. We can derive predictions for the amount of polarization generated in different frequency bands, and the typically polarization is suppressed by a factor of at least 10 to the minus 3 with respect to anisotropies in the intensity. So polarization is very small. But this is also good news because this means that if we will measure a highly polarized background, we can be sure that it will not be an astrophysical background. Okay, so up to now, everything was quite theoretical. I showed you theoretical predictions. Now we want to fill the gap between theory and observation. So we want to build estimators for the angular power spectrum of anisotropy and describe different noise components that are affecting this observable. I will distinguish between two noise components, what I call theoretical noise, that are noise components that we need to add to make our description more realistic, but that are independent of the characteristics of my detector or my detection method. And then there is instrumental noise. So among these theoretical noise, there is shot noise. People working with galaxy surveys are quite familiar with this noise component. Indeed, in my theoretical description, I was assuming that galaxies are around us distributed like a continuous field. But in reality, the distribution of galaxies in space is discrete. So a posteriori, I can correct for this, adding to my theoretical angular power spectrum a shot noise component that is flat in L space, and it looks like this. Now, the only thing to be noticed is that it goes down like 1/ commoving number density of galaxies at a given distance, and that it depends also on a cutoff a lower cutoff in distance, so on which is the flux threshold for the detectability of resolvable sources. Indeed, if I can resolve all sources as individual events up to a distance R star, then those sources have to be filtered out and they do not contribute anymore to my background budget. So if I add this guy, my total angular power spectrum will be dominated by the clustering part at large angular separations. And then it will start being dominated by this flat shot noise offset. Okay, then I remember, if you remember at the beginning of the talk, I was saying we need to keep in mind that the background visible by LIGO Virgo is quite different from the background visible by LISA, because LISA will see a continuous stationary background, while LIGO will see a background that is popcorn-like, like this. This fact, the fact that LIGO Virgo sees a background that is discrete in the time domain, was not implemented in my description. So a posteriori, I need to correct for this, adding to my angular power spectrum in the LIGO Virgo band, so in the Hertz band, a contribution called popcorn noise that is flat in L space that looks like the contribution we have seen before. But now here I have to substitute the total number of galaxies with the fraction of galaxies that contain a merger in the typical observation time. This fraction here is quite small. It is proportional to the observation time and the merger rate. So here I am dividing something by a quantity that is much smaller than one. So typically this guy here is quite big and dominates over the clustering component. So I stress again that this is something that applies only to the case of LIGO Virgo. LISA doesn't have this problem. So we are in a situation in which we have a clustering component that seems to be completely covered by this popcorn noise level. This is not a problem in the sense that both these guys contain astrophysical information. But if I am interested in the clustering part and I want to extract it, a way to go is to use cross-correlations with a galaxy map. Indeed, if I cross-correlate a map that is popcorn noise dominated with a galaxy map, this helps to extract the clustering part of the angular power spectrum out of the popcorn noise threshold. Mathematically, the reason why is that if you compute the signal-to-noise of the autocorrelation map, this looks like this, where this is my, I am assuming now that popcorn noise is the only noise component. So this signal-to-noise goes down like 1 over n squared. While if I do the same computation for the cross-correlation map, we see that the signal-to-noise goes down like 1 over n. So this guy here is much more enhanced than the signal-to-noise square of the autocorrelation. Here I show you a plot. I am plotting the signal-to-noise here of the autocorrelation, and this is of the cross-correlation as a function of the maximum angular resolution that one I achieve. And you see that there is a typical boost of a more than a factor of 10. So this is an interesting observable to look at. Good. So we have been talking about theoretical predictions, these popcorn noise and shot noise, and now let's describe instrumental noise. What I want to do is to have a description of the typical, to assume a given detector network, and predict which is the typical noise that I need to associate to a multiple in CL space. To do so, I need to build an estimator for the intensity that is quadratic in the strain, and to compute its covariance matrix. This is what I did recently with David Alonso in Oxford and group in Imperial. And this is a result that describes with the precision of, that gives an idea of the scaling of this this noise per multiple for a detector, for two detectors A and B. And this describes what's going on quite well for Earth-based detectors, while the LISA situation is much more complicated, and I will get back to this in a while. So what we see here is that there are three main ingredients. This noise goes down if I decrease the noise power spectra of the two detectors in the network. Then it goes down. Sorry, I forgot to say an important thing. So here what I'm doing is to assume that it's possible to split this omega into a frequency dependence part and an angular dependent one. And this alpha is just the slope of this frequency spectrum. And for an astrophysical background, this alpha here is coming from the quadrupole formula and is 2/3, while for a cosmological background is 0. Sorry. So I was saying that there are three ingredients. This is the baseline, so the distance between the two detectors in the network. So if I increase the baseline, the noise goes down, and then it goes down with the observation time. Here is a plot where I plot the this NL, so noise per multiple, for a frequency that I've chosen in around the sweet spot of LIGO Virgo, 63 Hz, as a function of N. This line here is the NL for a detector network given by LIGO Virgo and Kagra. Here I also add the Einstein telescope, and here I add also Cosmic Explorer. So in red here, to have just a comparison, I overplot the CLs, so the theoretical CLs for this frequency. This is the clustering component, and this is the popcorn noise level. So you see that a network that uses Einstein telescope plus Cosmic Explorer seems to be able to detect the very first multiples of this background. Quickly, here I show you the situation for LISA. The only relevant curve here is this last one that uses all possible combinations of detectors, because as you probably know, LISA has a triangular configuration, so it can be described as three nested interferometers. And you see that LISA is sensitive only to the very first even multiples. The reason why is that the response function of LISA is almost completely even under parity. I would need a second detector to break this symmetry and to start being sensitive to also odd multiples. Unfortunately, it seems that LISA will not be able to detect the anisotropies that are down here below this noise level. Okay. Let me go through the end. Just to summarize.
Can I ask a question here? Yes. So it seems this anisotropy is only detectable, let's say, for third generation detectors, like Einstein Telescope and Cosmic Explorer.
Yes, this seems to be the case. Yeah, go on.
But for these detectors, we probably will detect all the black hole mergers or neutron star mergers in our universe. In other words, most of the sources are resolvable. They're not background at all. So why do we need to do this in the 3G third generation detector era at all? I mean, they're all resolvable.
Well, that's true. That's a very good point, actually. That's true. Einstein telescope will has an horizon that is quite large. So we'll see as individual events a lot of events up to a very high redshift. The question is, which is the content? What is there in this background that can't be described with a catalog approach? And my answer is that you could use these two observables together, in the sense that if you use a catalog together with this background approach, you could pick up the contribution from a population of very faint sources that maybe you don't know that are there and that you wouldn't see as individual events. So
is your red curve dominated by like the brightest sources, or is it dominated by the fainter sources?
Which red curve?
Well, the signal curves, right? Like, you know, this popcorn and I mean, the popcorn component, the clustering component.
Okay. So, okay, that's another good point. So in these predictions, I didn't filter out any source. So I am considering the contributions of all sources, even if they could be detectable by a given instrument. Indeed, there are in the frequency band of LIGO-Virgo, there are two possible definitions of a background. The first one is detector independent, and you just say, my background is all what is there. I don't care about detectability. And the second definition is detector dependent, and you say, I call background all what I can't detect as an individual source, individual event. This distinction is not there for LISA, because LISA will see an intrinsic reducible background. But for LIGO-Virgo and also for Einstein Telescope, this distinction is important. And I am using always the first definition of a background. So I'm always giving predictions for all what is out there. Now, your question. There are predictions from the LIGO-Virgo collaboration where they give, if you want, so let me go back to this plot. If you remember the plot where I was showing the monopole here as a function of frequency, yes. So they show, for example, this purple curve that takes into account contributions from all sources detectable individually or not. And then they overplot another curve where they filter out sources that are detectable by LIGO-Virgo. And there is a small offset, but that's quite small for the moment. For Einstein Telescope, the situation would be probably different. I didn't see any prediction of this type. But of course, the origin of Einstein Telescope is much, much larger. Mm-hmm. Then, yes, just to conclude, this was an extremely important remark. Of course, these predictions are a bit pessimistic, but for the moment, I didn't consider what happens when you use cross correlations between. So here I'm always trying to detect these anisotropies, cross correlating a map of anisotropies with itself. A better way to go would be to cross correlate this map with a galaxy map, for example. And this would probably improve this situation for the first multiples of LISA. Okay, so this was a summary. We have different observables, these anisotropies, polarization, and then cross-correlation between anisotropies and different electromagnetic observables. There are different predictions on the market for different astrophysical models. And there are different methods already implemented to extract anisotropies, to build a map of anisotropies. Sorry, it's a bit late. To build a map of anisotropies out of observations and to extract an angular power spectrum. Up to my knowledge, there are no infrastructure for the moment to cross-correlate electromagnetic data and gravitational wave background data. And this is an extremely interesting direction to be explored. Okay, I go to my final slide. When I talk about this work, I like to conclude with this slide, where I present a parallel between the main steps of CMB discovery and study, and what potentially can happen for a gravitational wave background. This is an axis of increasing angular resolution, so the CMB was measured first by Pencet and Wilson in 65. 2 years later, there have been the first works to predict the anisotropy in the temperature, and the anisotropy was measured only 25 years later by the COBE mission. And as a theorist, I like this time gap, time scale, because it gives an indication of how sometimes theory anticipates observations and provides a guideline for them. Okay, let's go to this part. So for the moment, we don't have a detection of this background. The detection of the monopole will come very soon, probably already by the LIGO-Virgo collaboration in a few years. We will need to wait a third generation of detectors to build and measure a map of anisotropies. Of course, there are alternative detection methods to be explored, such as cross correlations with electromagnetic observables. So the discovery of the study of the CMB has been a huge revolution for cosmology. Before the discovery of the CMB, the paradigm of the odd Big Bang was not yet a paradigm, and then we entered a new era for precision cosmology. Yeah, astrophysics is in the situation where cosmology was 40 years ago. All astrophysical quantities and functions have huge uncertainties. The hope is that now we have a new observable that can be used potentially to set constants on some astrophysical functions, such as stellar evolution model, fraction of black holes in binary systems, mass range of black holes. Moreover, even if you are not interested in astrophysics, it is needed to have a description, proper description of the properties of this background if we want to be able to subtract it and study what is left, so cosmological backgrounds from inflation or early universe. With this, I conclude, and I thank you for your attention.
Thanks very much, Julia, for a very nice talk. We already had lots of discussion along the way. Do we have any more questions for Julia?
I have a question.
Okay.
Yes, please.
Do I go? Yeah, yes. So when you were computing this router for like differential cross-section for the scattering of gravitational waves of this objects, did you consider that they were like non-spinning objects?
Yes. Yes. So this is. Sorry, what is it?
Yeah, somewhere there.
Yeah. So this is the result for a Schwarzschild. So I'm assuming that this mass is static.
I see. No, there I mean, the it doesn't rotate, right?
Doesn't rotate. Yes, it's a Schwarzschild black hole. There are in the literature results for scattering cross sections for CAIR, only for some specific impact directions. I think it's a rotation.
Yeah. So, I'm just wondering: do the effect of the spin will you know have an impact in the you know in the end you want sources of polarization, right? So will that be important to consider, or can you just like do it with Schwarzschild black holes?
So I think that if you have a good way to describe that situation, of course, in this case, we had a nice analytic expression that was quite easy to derive predictions. In that case, if you want to consider an arbitrary impact direction, I think that you have to do everything numerically. Of course, no. It is more realistic to consider that situation. I don't have any intuition of how much the prediction for the amount of polarization that you generate would change, just because I would expect that the fact that the black hole is spinning would kind of add a contribution to this. But since the direction, the orientation of all these objects is arbitrary, I would somehow expect that the effect of spin would average out when you consider a multi diffusion process. But I should sit down and try to think a bit more of that.
Yeah, so in fact, like this paper that you're referring, which was actually one of Dolan's paper in the 2008, well, he described this impact of the way along the rotation axis. But actually, this can be extended and you know, you can find an analytic solution to any to arbitrary directions,
okay.
And you can go to higher orders in spin, which is actually something like simple to do.
There are analytic results for any impact direction. That's very
good. They are coming. We actually work
they
on
are
that.
Coming. So they're not even out yet.
but you know what I wanted to say is that you know if you check out Dolan's paper, he said that you know there is an induced polarization, which is linear in the spin of the black hole, and this induced polarization is because the differential cross section is now dependent of the frequency of the gravitational wave, and the change of sign of that frequency is going to give you an induced polarization. So, for an individual process, there is definitely a source of polarization,
mm-hmm.
but. I mean, and that you know continues if you go to higher orders in spin, but as you're saying, like it may be just you know average out, and mm-hmm. at the end wouldn't be like that important. But I was just curious to see.
Yeah, like, thanks a lot for the comments. So I will read your results for an arbitrary direction. I'm very curious.
Cool. Just to clarify for me, sorry. I mean, is this scattering dominated by compact objects like black holes, or instead is it dominated just by large scale structure?
Yes.
I would think it would be the latter, right? Because there's a lot of mass in large scale structure compared to compact objects.
That's a very good question. The only thing that I would like to clarify that I didn't mention before was that this is computed in the extreme wave optic regime. So for lambda, that is much, lambda is the wavelength that is much larger than the typical Einstein radius or Schwarzschild radius, if you want to be more stringent, than of my mass. So if you now take a very large mass, this result is not there anymore. You need to be in the wave optic regime. So if you consider large scale structure, there geometric optics is a good approximation to treat that scale. You see what you see my point?
I see. So you made some approximation which is not valid in the limit of having large extended perturbers.
So yes, this is the first order of an expansion in M nu, where nu is frequency and M is mass.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I see. Okay, thank you.
Okay, any further questions?
Yeah. Hi, Julia. In the calculation of the anisotropies in the Lisa band, have you considered the contribution from the local sources, for example, the Milky Way? I expect the Milky Way sources may contribute a lot to the anisotropy, especially for the low L.
Yes. Yes, absolutely. I am describing an extragalactic background. So I didn't consider any contribution from galactic sources. It is, as you said, well known that there is this irreducible galactic background that will, it is very important for LISA. And, but this is not what I am describing here. But that's true, what you say.
Okay. If you can give an estimate, if we take care of the galactic sources, how much it will affect the anisotropies? For example, by order 1, order 10?
So that's an independent contribution to your background, because you see, the basic building block in my computation were galaxies, in the sense that I am populating galaxies with objects. And now you're asking which is the contribution from sources inside my galaxy. So I can't answer this question using this approach. I should have a model for the distribution of sources inside my galaxy and compute from this map an angular power spectrum.
Okay, thank you.
I guess that we could answer Jen's question just by looking at the light from our galaxy compared to the light from other galaxies, right?
Probably, yes.
Yeah.
Assuming that, yes, there is that this is a tracer, probably this is a good tracer, yes, of the gravitational wave radiation of a galaxy.
Yeah, for the galactic one, we're talking about white dwarfs, right? Are we talking about white dwarfs?
Yes.
In the Lisa band, yeah.
Yeah, so light probably is not a good tracer.
Why? but, stars trace each other spatially, right? White dwarfs will be in the disk and we have luminous stars in the disk, right?
Yes, on the other side, that's also true that what I am describing here in terms of extragalactic background is something that doesn't have any electromagnetic counterpart, because I am considering mergers and gravitational waves from binary systems of compact objects that do not emit electromagnetic radiation.
Sure, but those sources of gravitational waves are in the same places where we have sources of light, right?
Yes, I think that indeed in first approximation one can, in other terms, so you look at the mass of a galaxy somehow and you say more galaxies that are more massive are expected to be brighter in both electromagnetic and gravitational waves. Mm-hmm. In very first approximation, I think that is fine. Then one has to refine this. I don't know if I answered that question that I had at the beginning. I said I'm sure that I will answer it later about the astrophysical information that is encoded inside this observable. Probably the person who asked the question left.
Yeah, Louis left.
Okay.
Yeah, it was Louis, right? Yeah, he left. Okay, any other questions or comments? Okay, if not, then let's thank Julia again for this wonderful talk, and I'll stop the recording here.